Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. It's Q&A with Layla. This is part two of today's Q&A session. Each week, we endeavor to answer your questions, questions that you send to us via radio program at AOL.com. That's the email address for questions, and we reserve the right to screen your questions for general applicability and suitability and brevity, because we can't really address a very, very detailed medical problems. That's what we do on a daily basis in the office. And so come see us. Come see me and Layla together, or you can see Layla on an individual basis for nutritional advice in support of whatever medical condition you may be suffering from. Our next question is going to be on root canal, correct?
Yeah. This comes from Charlie in Virginia. What is your opinion of root canal?
Well,
that's a big one, because thinking right away about autoimmunity.
Yes. So let's talk about, first of all, what is a root canal? Well, a root canal is a procedure that enables people to save their teeth by denervating the tooth, in effect taking away the nerve and filling the tooth with a substance that is anti-infective, and basically reinforcing the tooth so that you maintain both the cosmetic appearance and also the functionality of the tooth. And that sounds like a good idea, because in the old days, before root canals were a relatively recent innovation, they used to pull out bad teeth, and then you would have gaps, or you'd have, like my grandfather. I remember my grandfather, he was an old man when I was a little kid, but he was probably about 45, you know, but to me, he was always an old man.
Okay.
He was an old man. So, but he, whenever, you know, my parents sometimes parked me with him, and he was divorced. So he was just a single, you know, 45-year-old divorcee. And so sometimes my parents would say, look, we want to go out, you know, to a nightclub or something. Why don't you stay with your grandpa? So fine, I would stay with my grandpa. And every night he would put his teeth in a glass. I remember it like today. And he would sort of have that sort of gummy look. And he would say, good night. Maybe sort of gumming the words. Because he was, and the reason for that is, he was a prosperous guy. He was a successful businessman. And in those days, it was actually a mark of good dentistry to be able to afford to have all your teeth pulled. You know, if you were a poor person, you couldn't go to the dentist, so you'd have these like blackened, broken, stained teeth, and you'd be constantly suffering from toothaches. And he had like, you know, fancy dentures. He was proud of his dentures because they were the best that money could buy, and he'd had his teeth taken out by the time he was 50. So there's been a change, obviously, in dental philosophy. We want to retain teeth, both for aesthetic purposes, and, you know, dentures can be a nuisance, and also for nutritional purposes. It's important, you know, your nutrition is really compromised if you have, you know, lots and lots of gaps or bridges. Bridges are one of the ways where you can, you know, deal with that. But, you know, sometimes those appliances are cumbersome. So here's the problem. When you clean out this tooth and you leave it there, and it's painless because they're taking the nerve out, what you may have is what you could term a faulty tower. You know, there's actually, I think it was like, there was like a British comedy show, Faulty Towers.
Yes, Faulty Towers. Yes.
Faulty Towers, right. So you had to be in.
It was followed by Blackadder, but that's another conversation.
Was that like a 1980s thing or something? I don't even know.
Yeah,
okay. So that's a little cultural reference. But anyway, so these are like faulty towers, and they may harbor bacteria that, where you don't know that it's causing a problem because there's no nerve. So, in effect, you've got these outposts that are outposts of infection that directly communicate with your bloodstream. And the toxins that are from the bacteria, actually the bacteria themselves, may migrate into your bloodstream and cause you to have systemic disease or trigger autoimmunity and create mischief in your body. And this actually, there's a book about this by a dentist.
Hal Huggins
written, but there's also a specific book about root canals by a guy who's since deceased. His name is Dr. I think George Meinig, M-E-I-N-I-G, and he states the case against root canals. So,
yeah.
So what are you going to do? I mean, on the one hand, you know, if you believe that, then you're going to have every bad tooth taken out. I mean, I personally had a root canal put in when I was in med school. I was actually in my medical training. And it's an interesting story because a root canal, they say, is one of the worst dental experiences you can undertake. You know, it's just like horrible. But I was.
Wait, there's Novocaine.
I know. This. Look, okay. I'm not that old. They had Novocaine, you know, when I had this done. But I have to say that I was so exhausted and tired and overworked that when I had to have my root canal done, they said, okay, go ahead, take a few hours off, go to the dentist. I was so happy to just be lying there and relaxing and having somebody else work on me instead of me working on them that I just fell asleep through the whole procedure and it was fine. That must have been in the early 80s. And then about 20 years later, suddenly I started to have discomfort and swelling around that root canal. And I went to my favorite dentist and he said, you know, it's actually a personal friend of mine. He said, Ron, he said, it's infected. He says, oh, I said, oh my goodness. So I said, what should I do? And he said, well, you have your choice. You know, I can give you some antibiotics and get rid of it. But it's very hard to cure an infection that's in the tooth because it's literally in the bone. These are infections that are very hard to eradicate. So if you really want to deal with it definitively, let's pull the tooth. And I hated like hell to lose the tooth, but I said, look, get it out because I don't want to take antibiotics, number one. Number two, I don't want it to keep coming back. And who knows if it's not seeding my body with toxins. And so that was my choice. I'm happy that I made that choice. I now have it's like a phony tooth, which is a bridge. It's bridged over between two other teeth. So everything's fine now. But, you know, if you have multiple teeth, it's tougher to make that decision. Then, of course, you can go this route where you then get implants. You know, you have your teeth taken out, then you get the implants. But that's a whole other story because people are sometimes sensitive to the metals, the titanium from, you know, et cetera, and the so-called neutral metals that are there. So,
you know, that's a process that could take up to a year. But there is also the question still of autoimmunity because now there's this foreign object living in your bone.
Yes, deep embedded, know? Deep within your bone. And the other thing about it is there's actually an interaction between these types of problems and the osteoporosis medications. People who've had invasive procedures in their mouths, either extractions or recent extractions or implants, actually have a greater potential to get osteonecrosis of the jaw when they take these drugs like Actonel and Beneva and Fosamax and Reclast because they, whenever there's inflammation or irritation present, it acts as a focus on which these osteoporosis drugs can act to promote jaw destruction. So there's, again, a whole gamut of issues related to that. I don't know. You know, I think it's a tough decision to get a lot of teeth pulled rather than get them restored. But I think it's the ideal solution to get it. You know, if your tooth is infected and it's bad, it should probably come out. That would be my suggestion.
I guess that would be the opinion of most biological dentists, I imagine. I personally don't have any root canals or anything, knock wood.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, that would be something to think about.
I mean, it can happen anyway. You know, when I was a kid, I won the smiles contest in my school. I had great teeth. But then, you know, like, you know, at the passage of time, you know, stuff happens. So anyway, that's a controversial area. And, you know, you may want to consult, you know, just as sometimes when you have a medical dilemma, you go to a conventional medical practitioner to get an opinion about what they would do on a conventional level. You may want to see a, quote, biological dentist or a holistic dentist. Who can offer you a different perspective on the problem and suggest other ways to deal with it.
Okay. Best of luck, Charlie. Okay. Our next question comes from Paul. Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. My wife had recently had a baby girl, and then she got mastitis.
Uh-huh.
She's since been given antibiotics for this.
For a listening audience, let's describe what that is. Mastitis, I mean, some people don't know, it's an infection of the breast or the nipple, and it's very common in nursing moms, and it's, you know, very painful, and it's horrible because you're trying to nurse your baby, and that can be a painful ordeal in and of itself. And if your nipples are cracked and infected, and, you know, then it's what a mess. I mean, it's really horrible. Yep. And it interferes with nursing.
It doesn't interfere with nursing. It could also be caused by engorged breasts that are engorged with milk and may cause abscess and so forth, and then mastitis. How to prevent it? I would defer to a lactation specialist at your local hospital where your baby was born, your baby girl was born. I would go there first for any kind of advice. But yes, antibiotics are necessary for the mastitis. I can't think of any other way to get rid of it.
Well, I have an interesting other solution for that. And here it is. It's Manuka honey for mastitis. Oh, yeah. Yep.
Wonderful.
There actually is a company that makes a product that is a little, you know, like those strippers wear like pasties. Like certain places, you know, you can't do like nude dance.
I said that too definitively. I know what you're talking about.
I think you've heard tell, not that you know firsthand. I don't know. But, you know, it's sort of like a little cup that you place over the nipple. It is saturated with Manuka honey. And it does two things. Honey, first of all, is a great antibacterial. It's been used since time immemorial for ulcerations and surface injuries. But Manuka honey has a special quality because it is from derived from honey where bees visit the Manuka plant. And so it's rich in natural antibacterial compounds. It's also suggested, and it sounds kind of weird too, you can apply raw garlic. You can apply apple cider vinegar.
Baby's never going to go to the breasts again if you do raw garlic.
Well, only if the
baby can't see that. If you want to continue breastfeeding,
only if the baby is Korean or Italian, they might. They might.
Okay.
It's an ethnic thing. You know, it's a matter of preference.
Yeah.
No, I'm just being facetious. I mean, look. What's actually interesting is there are some studies on breast milk preference in babies, and if mom eats a lot of garlic, then the breast milk will actually be garlic flavored. And that doesn't turn off babies. Babies actually find that appealing. So that they actually studied that. But Manuka honey actually has some track record in treating mastitis. And of course, you really would prefer a more natural regime in terms of dealing with that. But I, you know, look, the best people to consult on that would be naturopathic physicians or as you say, lactation consultants.
Specialists, yeah.
Nurse midwives, because that's their expertise.
They know.
And they have, like, traditional knowledge. I mean, I think this is a problem that has occurred since maybe, you know, 10,000 years ago. And there was always a wise, usually older woman in the tribe who had a great deal of experience in these matters and knew the importance of breastfeeding, and they would apply various types of natural poultices, because they didn't have antibiotics in those days, to try and alleviate that. And there are some natural plant compounds that can address it. So that's something that there may be a workaround. I mean, in the worst case scenario, yes, antibiotics, but, you know, preferably not.
Yeah. Paul actually has a second part to his question. He's complaining about lack of sleep. Now, his baby girl was born just a month ago, in the middle of August. What are some ways we can maintain healthiness during this period of not getting enough sleep? And any ideas to what period a baby normally obtains a full 8 hours of sleep? My wife can't wait for this to occur.
Yeah.
Welcome to having an infant.
Right. You know, it's
really, that's what that is.
I just did a podcast.
Here's the thing.
Yeah. I just did a podcast on kids' health.
Go on.
Yeah. I just did a podcast on kids' health. And actually, this is a topic that's very important for kids, is the issue of how do you promote optimal sleep for children. And, you know, clearly you don't, put knockout drops into their milk. But there are, you know, there are some ways of structuring the sleep, of, you know, lullabying the kid or lulling them to sleep. Some kids respond well to, you know, there are different ways to put them down, you know, as they say, as parents sometimes say.
Well, but because this baby girl is only about 5 weeks old, there's still, you know, 2 a.m. feedings and 4 a.m. feedings and all of this. It's a matter of what I would say for Paul's wife is to sleep when the baby is sleeping, including naps during the day.
Right.
Now, that's some common advice I've heard even in my own family.
Right.
Oh, baby's sleeping? Go take a nap. Go take a nap because you're tired, too. And you're going to be up every few hours during the night.
Yeah. And the question is there such a thing as a sleep substitute? I mean, sleep is something very important. It's hard to offset the effects of sleep deprivation with a supplement program. I mean, yes, you should be taking the right kind of supplements, but I'm not sure.
Could you imagine if there was a substitute for sleep? That would be $1 million idea. That would just be amazing. Yeah.
Well, when you say
people become way overproductive.
When you say $1 million, that reminds me of like Dr. Evil in the it's like he goes, "We'll ransom the world for $1 million." No, we're talking $1 trillion, I think.
$1 trillion.
Yeah, right.
$1 million doesn't cut it anymore.
Yeah, that's because I think he was put into suspended animation sleep from the 1960s. So he thinks $1 million is still a lot of money. But now that it's the 21st century, it's like, no, think again.
Yeah.
All right. So, this is the who said parenthood was healthy for you? It's not necessarily.
I never did it, so I don't know.
Yeah, this is coming from two childless practitioners here. I can't really tell.
That's right.
I can only sympathize. Yeah. I can't empathize. All right.
Right, but congratulations on your baby girl, Paul.
Hey, it's worth it.
Your wife feels better soon.
It's worth it. It'll pay off.
Yeah.
All right. So, mastitis and sleeplessness. Oh, wow, what a lousy combination. Mm. Yeah, nasty.
Mm.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Our next question comes from Rachel.
Yeah.
Can a mild fatty liver and gallstones interfere with vitamin D absorption?
Well,
I don't think so.
I don't think so. Yeah, I don't think so.
Yeah.
But I did a whole. Two things. I did actually an article in our newsletter, which is now posted, and I did a podcast on the subject of fatty liver recently. So, we offer tips for fatty liver. And, the main thing I'll say about that, and there's lots of tips there, I think 21 tips for dealing with fatty liver, is that you may think it's about too much dietary fat, but it's not. So why don't you take it from there, Layla? What dietary component causes fat to be deposited in the liver?
Fatty liver is caused by high triglycerides in the body, which then turns the liver fatty. And too many triglycerides, we know, happens from eating too many carbohydrates,
right.
Sugars and starches.
Yep.
So fat does not cause a fatty liver. Indeed, it is the carbohydrates and the sugars that are the foe.
Right.
So, yeah. As far as vitamin D absorption, things that might inhibit vitamin D absorption wouldn't be a fatty liver or gallstones, but if you had any GI issues, if you had malabsorption issues, if you had celiac disease and you're not gluten-free, if you're eating a lot of allergenic foods that you shouldn't be, if you have a leaky gut or something like that,
people who are
malabsorbing.
I think where she's going with that, maybe, in my opinion, is that she may be fat intolerant, because sometimes when you have gallstones, fat triggers a constriction of your gallbladder. And so maybe she's going, because she hears, I have stones, I have fatty liver, she's on an ultra-low-fat diet, and an ultra-low-fat diet may not be conducive to the absorption of fat-soluble nutrients. That's a possibility, but
that's true.
It's a little. I'm trying to think.
That's true.
Well,
how that might Rachel,
be.
First of all, you want to get sun in summer, primarily between the hours of 11 and 1, 11 a.m. and 1 p.m. Exactly when your dermatologist told you not to go out into the sun. Get out there for 20 minutes, half an hour. Have your skin turn just a little bit pink, and you will likely make anywhere around 20,000 international units of vitamin D under your skin. Unless you're over the age of 65 or so, you're going to make maybe 25% of that amount.
Right. As you age, or dark-skinned individuals have their skin is, in effect, protected from ultraviolet, which also requires longer exposure to make the vitamin D. That's why a lot of darker skinned individuals are vitamin D deficient, because they, you know, even if they, first of all, they don't care because they're already, quote, tan, so they don't understand why these Caucasians are always trying to get darker. You know, it's, for them, it's like no big deal. Generally, skin's already dark. But it's also about duration of sun exposure required to trigger synthesis of vitamin D.
Okay.
So we have time for, I think, one quick question. Do we have a quick one that we can?
A quick one.
Yep.
Okay. I hope this is a quick one.
All right, we'll see.
Dear Dr. H and Layla, great show as always. What do you think of platelet-rich plasma injections for arthritis, tennis and golfer's elbow, and rotator cuff injuries?
Well,
platelet-rich plasma injections. What do you think?
Well, you know, I think that's it's sort of a controversial area, because whenever you're dealing with painful conditions and you do something, you with an injection, and it's a procedure, and it's highly touted, and you pay a fee, there's a very big placebo effect. So it's actually, it's kind of hard, it's even been hard to study that, because they say, well, you know, okay, you give a placebo injection versus a PRP injection. I think the studies are a little bit back and forth on that, and some people seem to respond, and whether or not, you know, that's because pain and arthritis waxes and wanes anyway is unclear. I think it's worth a try, and, you know, it's one of the techniques. I mean, eventually they also are going to be using more and more stem cells that are either derived from adipose tissue around the belly or derived from the bone marrow. The bone marrow-derived stem cells may be even more effective at repairing knees and
hips.
That
is so exciting.
Yeah.
That is so exciting.
It's just not ready for prime time yet, in my opinion. I think they're just beginning to tap the potential of that, and I think some practitioners are they're a little too far ahead of the curve. They claim all kinds of amazing restorative benefits of stem cells for all manner of disease, you know, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, conditions that are really horrible dead-end conditions where people are desperate. And
paraplegic, quadriplegic.
Yeah, I mean, we just don't know. I mean, you know, you can go to China and, you know, spend $30,000 and they'll inject stem cells into your spinal cord for better or for worse. Who knows?
Yeah. Okay. What would be good for arthritis, tennis, golfer's elbow, rotator cuff, anti-inflammatories, fish oil?
Curcumin has actually been shown to be helpful for tendinitis, yeah.
Yeah.
So tendinitis, that is a form of tendinitis. Sure. Mm-hmm. Those are some things that could help. So, you know, acupuncture too, even may be beneficial for something like that. All right.
Wonderful.
So that pretty much wraps it up for today. A reminder, you can email us your questions to our radio program at AOL.com. Once again, a happy new year to many of our listeners who are celebrating New Year's. And we will rejoin. What are we going to do next week? We're going to just do another. I'm trying to think of the right word.
We're going to do another Q&A next week.
We're going to do another Q&A next week. Just put it simply.
Right.
Okay. So, yeah,
Same time, same station.
So if you enjoy listening to podcasts, just subscribe via iTunes or Stitcher, or download the podcast from drhoffman.com. Spread the word. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.